Welcome to Free Thoughts. I'm Trevor Burrus.
And I'm Aaron Powell.
Joining us today is Christopher J. Coyne, Associate Professor of Economics at George Mason University, and Abigail R. Hall, Assistant Professor of Economics at the University of Tampa. Together, they are the authors of Tyranny Comes Home, The Domestic Fate of U.S. Militarism. Welcome to Free Thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thanks.
Now, you're both economists. So why would economists write a book as opposed to political scientists or historians or whatever, a book about American militarism?
So this is part of a broader research program that we've been involved in for several years, looking at various parts of U.S. policy, specifically foreign policy, but trying to bring some of the fundamental insights of economics to understanding both the limits and possibilities of that foreign policy. And so, you know, it's the way we view it is kind of the consistent application of the economic way of thinking, relative prices, scarcity, constraints, incentives, knowledge constraints, and so on. And to our way of thinking, many of these issues are neglected in typical kind of IR, international relations treatments of these issues, public policy discussions. And so we think there's important kind of light to be shed on a variety of topics using the economic way of thinking. And so those can be things from intervening abroad and trying to shape institutions. But in the case of this project, thinking about how foreign intervention and militarism can affect domestic life.
Do you have a definition of militarism, like how you're using that term throughout this conversation?
So the way we think about militarism is the, and of course, a variety of different scholars have talked about it, is the reliance or primacy of the military means as a way of interacting, shaping, and influencing military affairs. That's one aspect of it. The related aspect then is that militarism influences the domestic fabric, if you will, social fabric, political fabric, economic fabric of domestic life. And so the way we view militarism is kind of a dominant ideology of military primacy, where pretty much every problem or most problems around the world and domestically for that matter, when you think about things like the war on terror, the war on drugs, are viewed as being solved at least partially, if not entirely, through military means.
You make a big distinction too. So we're looking at the size and scope of government, or the scope and scale you guys talk about, and how could militarism be a particular sort of input into this, but you make a big distinction between scale and scope. So what is that distinction?
So when we talk about scale, we're meaning just the overall size of government. And economists are really good at measuring scale. So you can look at things like government spending as a percentage of GDP. You can look at the number of people who are employed by the federal government. There are lots of different measurements that we can use to talk about scale. Where it's often neglected, though, is the issue of scope, which would be, well, what are the activities that government is engaged in? And we talk about several reasons that economists and others tend to ignore issues of scope. So it's assumed to be correlated with scale. So you assume that if the scale of government is growing, the scope of government is also growing. There are also issues with how economists and others typically model government activities. So the way that government's portrayed is that it's providing goods and services in the optimal amount. So they're maximizing some kind of a welfare function. Defense goods are a part of that. And so it tends to be ignored. We focus in on scope because I think listeners will probably appreciate that model of government is probably not the best for understanding how it is that government actually provides resources, defense included. But we also focus in on scope because the tools that we're using for this particular project are particularly well-tuned to shed light on issues related to scope. So by going through and working with this framework that we've developed, by looking into the historical cases that we do, we're positioning ourselves to be able to use those economic tools to explain a part of government action that's often neglected.
And it's not particularly quantitative too, that's important. There's no graph. I mean, I didn't find a single graph, or at least a numerical graph in your book, or how you measure this. Because if you just measure GDP expenditure, or how many people work for the government, as you pointed out, Abby, that it might half of them might be defense attorneys. All right, you might have a huge, and they would to protect the rights of criminal defendants. So you can't, if you just measure how many people are employed by the government, you're not actually measuring how much they protect rights or violate them.
That's exactly right. And the other interesting thing from an economic standpoint is we typically talk about technological advances in the context of private markets and private life. And one of the, of course, key insights that we have from private peaceful interaction markets and so on is that you get innovation, you get technological advances. Though that lowers the cost of doing things, which in markets we tend to say is a good thing. But that also applies to technological advances for the state. And so as the state acquires and develops tools of social control that lowers the cost of them violating people's rights, you actually need fewer resources to utilize those effectively. And so not only do kind of crude aggregate macro measures miss these nuances, but they also miss kind of the dynamics of innovation and what that means for the amount of resources necessary to carry out an increased range of activities.
What are the drivers of, if we're seeing increased militarism, and we're talking about this from an economic standpoint, so there's incentives and there's interests that are being pursued and so on. I mean, we can obviously, like, the military or people who are making money off of the military have an interest in increasingly using the military or growing it or solving, I have that in scare quotes, solving problems through the application of military force. But are there other, like, what are the kind of non-just, you know, defense contractor driven things that are causing more militarism?
So that's a great question. It's a big topic, of course, and I think the answer is multifaceted. And so I won't do full justice to it, but I think you clearly have incentives of interest groups driving this. But I also think there's a broader ideological shift in the case of America that happened over time. And of course, there's ebbs and flows over time, but really kind of the focal point, if you will, is the post World War II period. And there was a major ideological shift at that time. Which again is, it was driven by numerous factors, but there was a acceptance both in the policy establishment of the foreign policy community as well as among a large number of American citizens that America was going to be involved and had to be involved globally, that there was going to be a state of kind of total war, if you will, and permanent war to combat the communist threat. And so in the wake of the world wars, you get the onset of the Cold War, and that this wasn't going to be like historical wars where you had kind of this ramping up of resources, expenditures, and military might. You engaged against a clear, identifiable enemy. And once that enemy was defeated, the war was over, if you will. Instead, this was going to be a situation where, you know, the enemy was an ideology, a set of beliefs. And so that was something that needs to be combated both across geographic space, but also domestically, because you could have infiltrators domestically that would erode the American way of life. And it was going to be open-ended. And that influenced the shape of foreign policy. It influenced economic activity associated with war production. And so you get the onset of what people have called the permanent war economy, where instead of just shifting resources to increase certain military outputs, we had to prepare for future wars as well. And of course, the military contractors that you mentioned played into that, which is once you had this ideology in place, of course, they benefit greatly from the persistence of that type of setup.
To add on to that, the examples that I always use, and they're important for not only what we do in this book, but in other pieces that we've written as well, is looking at the importance of the war on drugs and the war on terror. So Chris mentioned a moment ago that in prior conflicts, you have a very clearly well-defined enemy, and that enemy is external. But there is now this internal component when you've got the war on drugs and the war on terror. And so you have this tendency, I think, which is natural when people are afraid of something, they want people to come in and fix it. And the people in this case that are coming in to fix it are our government. And people become more comfortable over time with these intrusions on their personal liberties because there is that fear component that's there. The example that I use oftentimes with my undergraduate students is that they don't remember what it was like to fly pre-9/11, because at this point, most of them weren't born yet. But had you told someone in 1995, for example, that every time they went to the airport, their full body was going to be scanned, they could be pat down by some government agent, now the TSA, a lot of people would have told you that you were crazy. Now we think about that as being normal and a necessary security procedure.
And I get that's a way of putting, I think, the thesis generally of the book, which is historically, we would have said, what is the main cost to America domestically for fighting, say, a war in Vietnam or a war in the Philippines, as a lot of this stuff seems to begin. And it would be, oh, well, taxes and lives of American soldiers, those are the main costs that come back to America. And but you say no, that there's actually what you call the boomerang effect, that there are more costs to this that are more deeply ingrained within the social fabric that happens, as Abby said, maybe without even you noticing it, suddenly we're being patted down at airports or other things. So talk a little bit more about the boomerang effect and how that works.
Sure. And so as you point out, one of the key kind of insights in the book is a very basic point that comes out of economics, Frederick Bastiat and then Henry Hazlitt, of course, about the unseen. And as Hazlitt put it, the art of economics is not just analyzing the observable consequences of a policy, but also the chain of events that occurs, much of which is unseen. And so really, in some sense, that's what's driving us here. We're trying to identify some of the main unseen and overlooked cost of a proactive militaristic foreign policy. And so how do we go about doing that? Well, we tried to develop a broad framework to think about these issues, drawing upon some of the insights from the economic way of thinking. And the boomerang effect, what we call the boomerang effect, in its core logic goes as follows. Foreign intervention provides a testing ground, if you will, or laboratory for governments to innovate, sharpen, and refine tools of social control over other human beings. When governments intervene abroad, or the American government does, there are relatively few constraints on what it can do, which we go through in the book, the weakness of those constraints or the significant slack in those constraints. And so an unconstrained government, or largely unconstrained government, will undertake actions that it otherwise wouldn't at home if it was constrained, and will feel comfortable doing things to other human beings that they otherwise couldn't do if they were effectively constrained. Under certain conditions, the innovations in social control that take place both in preparing for and executing foreign interventions return back to domestic life through a variety of channels that we discuss. And when that happens, the American government not only becomes more effective at controlling other people, but also the domestic citizenry as well. The relationship between domestic citizens and politics and political institutions changes, and kind of the fabric of domestic life changes for the worse oftentimes. And that can lead to a variety of immediate consequences, but also long-term consequences as well. And so really one of the key themes of the book is that foreign interventions create institutional precedent. They create precedents that oftentimes can sit there for long periods of time unused, but future politicians can use them. They can draw upon the precedents that are created. And those precedents can be legal precedents. They can be technological precedents, and then they can be used in ways that were unintended at the time of their initial design and implementation.
So is this different? One thing that we hear a bunch about, say, the New Deal, is that a lot of the people who created the New Deal had been involved with the wartime economy in World War I. And we put ourselves on a wartime footing and everything was planned and we had to centralize and we all have one goal. And that seemed really, really good. And then they were refugees for the Coolidge and Harding years and Hoover years. And then they come back in the Roosevelt years and say, well, right, wartime was great. Why can't we have a permanent wartime footing for the economy? Is that a similar kind of claim that you guys are making, or at least in the same kind of
side?
Certainly,
it's similar. And if I had to generalize from that point, that's a wonderful example. It is that people develop certain skills, certain what economists call human capital, which is influenced by their experiences, what they do, what they become experts in doing. And that's going to influence their future, what they do in the future. And also to the extent they're involved in policy, in influencing organizations and institutions, the shape that those things take. If I had to summarize one of the key takeaways, you can never just do one thing. And so an intervention, even a well-targeted, well-designed intervention, is going to have a series of consequences which you cannot fully anticipate, which you cannot fully measure. And it's something to take into account when we're thinking about foreign policy.
Is there a way to make the unseen seen in this instance? I mean, so one of the ways to address these incentives would be to make the unseen more seen, these costs more obvious. And I mean, you can do it, like, obviously your book is a step in that direction, but most people aren't reading books of
academic
this type
books, yeah.
of academic books. Are there ways to adjust the incentives here to at least push back on this tendency?
Edward Snowden did it, I guess. He made some unseen things seen.
I think that is a it's a really tall order. One of the things that I know I frequently am pushing back on is that we know that there are lots of unintended consequences of conflict. And one of the things that I know came out for me from writing this book was looking to see how, in some cases, as Chris pointed out, you have things that have been on the books for a very long time, or things take a really long time to develop. And so some of those unintended consequences, you might not see them for, I mean, forget months, it might be years or decades. But the fact that there are lots of unintended cost associated with conflict, whether we're talking about the loss of liberties, we're talking about environmental impacts, there's a whole list of things that we could discuss. I think one shift that I would like to see, I think it's probably, again, not likely to happen, is the impetus really needs to be on people who then are proponents of conflict to come to the table and have some way of articulating or offering some kind of a reasonable explanation for why we wouldn't expect to see these types of consequences that we historically have seen with pretty much every conflict.
One of my favorite things about your book is that you do break it down. And as I pointed out, many people have said, you know, the same people in World War I were in the New Deal, but you kind of break it down and say, well, this is what actually is going on. So in the one that Chris mentioned, the Human Capital Channel, if you create a bunch of generals and soldiers, for example, to fight a war overseas, they might come back and be cops, which happens a bunch in the story. But you have these basic things like extreme confidence regarding the interventionist's ability to solve complex problems in other societies through massive bureaucratic public-private apparatus. So there's five more you talk about, but just like that one, it's the kind of thing that you learn, right? And then you're no longer just relegated to working in foreign countries now. You might come back and get a job.
That's right. And so we term this the interventionist mindset. And really, you know, to understand this, that list of propositions that you just mentioned, the first one. And one of the core kind of foundation things we discuss in the book, and I think it's important for people to talk about, irrespective of where they fall down on how interventionist America or other governments should be, is what does intervention in other societies require? And at its core, it requires force or the threat thereof. It requires social control. Social control is the rules and the different ways of life. Those rules can be formal or informal that people follow to get things done. And what intervention ultimately requires, to varying degrees, of course, depending on the type of intervention, is a group of outsiders saying, I don't like what's happening in that society. Of course, if they didn't have that kind of view that they didn't like what happened, there'd be no urge to intervene to change things. And intervention tries to change what naturally would occur otherwise. And that requires controlling people. And that requires a certain mindset, a certain mental schema, if you will. And that's what you're getting at when you talk about, look, you have to have confidence in the ability of government to change things. You have to have confidence and comfort telling other people how to live their life and backing that up by force if they refuse to do so.
And limited compassion and sympathy toward the target populace. I like that one.
That's right. That's right. And you capture that. You know, this is bipartisan. We've all heard politicians like talk about Iraq and Afghanistan, the failure, not as a failure of U.S. policy, but as somehow the failure of the recipients of, and they'll put it in terms of a gift. We bestowed upon the folks of Iraq and Afghanistan the right to be free or democracy, and they chose to reject it. Well, that's certainly one way to view it. Another is that they didn't view it as the gift that you're framing it as. And so there's a certain kind of framing that goes here. There's a disregard typically for a human life of non-Americans. And you see this in the way U.S. policymakers and those in the military talk about it. The way they frame it, collateral damage, the unwillingness to in many cases have base even attempt to count the number of civilians lost or to make it as opaque as possible. Going back to your point about what kind of things could we do to make this more transparent, there's constraints, there's data you could make available, but oftentimes in government, of course, they take active steps to mask this data so that people can't have access to it and understand the full implications of it.
Is that kind of pivot from it wasn't our failure to it was, you know, it wasn't our failure, it was their failure, how you get around? I mean, so when Trevor first mentioned this, like kind of they go in and then they have this overconfidence in the ability of large bureaucratic systems, in this case military systems, to solve problems, it clashes with, I mean, most of the people who I've talked to serve in the military come out being like, man, we had no idea what we were doing. Like, they don't come out with confidence in these systems. And we, you know, making fun of the incompetence of the, I mean, there's the new Catch-22 movie is coming out. Like, that doesn't seem, it doesn't seem like we have this broad consensus that the military is this well-oiled machine that gets things done.
Or at least, especially people who've been in the military.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think it probably depends on, and Chris may have other things to add to this as well. I think part of that, it depends on who it is that you're talking to coming out from the military. Because I know in my experience, it's been something very similar. When I present this or other research to former members of the military, the first few times I was surprised because I found a lot of them agreed with me. And they're saying, yes, you're telling us things that we actually lived through. So they've experienced the bureaucracy. But I do think that there is some potentially a meaningful difference in maybe where you are within that organization. So for those people who have been able to climb the military ladder, and we talk about this in the book, they've illustrated that they are really good at playing that game. So they're able to do the things which are pleasing to their superiors, to engage in the actions which are going to make them successful within that organization. And so the people that I might be talking to or who might be coming to me are not those people who've been able to make a career out of the military. They're people who spent, you know, 4 or 8 years in and then left. And I think that's an important distinction to make.
Now, let's get some specifics here. So we're talking the abstracts, but you do a very good job of saying this is exactly how it works. And the first one you talk about is surveillance. I think most people expect a large amount of surveillance from the U.S. government in their life, which wasn't always the case. But that itself, some of those institutions and technologies have roots in foreign intervention.
In the book, we kind of talk about the boomerang effect framework. We talk about America specifically in the constraints or lack thereof related to foreign intervention. And then we shift into kind of four illustrations or case studies. And surveillance is the first one we discuss. And, you know, one of the interesting things that came about in all the cases that we discussed and studied for this book is just how far back they go. Of course, you know, people think about surveillance to the extent they think about it at all. And a lot of people say, okay, the NSA, Snowden. And then, you know, if you just look up a history of the NSA, you see, oh, early 50s, that's the NSA. And you say, okay, that's the history of this thing. But it's not. There's a much deeper history when you delve into it. There's always been surveillance, of course, of varying types. As long as there's been wars, there's been governments, they always surveil, whether it's directly observing, having spies, opening people's mail. Those are all forms of surveillance throughout history, as well as many others. But in the case of America, you can trace back the origins of the modern day surveillance state to the war in the Philippines. So we're talking late 1800s into the early 1900s. And of course, the war in the Philippines is one that you don't hear too many people talk about. But in many of the cases that we talk about in the book, you can trace back the origins to that. And of course, when the America or the American government, I should say, took over the Philippines, many of the citizens that lived in the Philippines were expecting to be granted independence. But the American government wasn't ready to grant them independence. As you can imagine, that led to great unhappiness and a meeting of resistance by people living in the country being occupied and being told what to do. So how are you going to fight the insurgents? Part of it was brute force. The American military apparatus engaged in brute force. But for the first time, the American government also established a apparatus of surveillance under someone named Ralph Van Diemen, who's called the father of military intelligence. He's in the Military Intelligence Hall of Fame. There is such a thing. And what he did, which was quite genius at the time, was use all the available technology available to him. Now, again, by today's standards, of course, it would be very rudimentary. He collected enormous amounts of information on people and used that information to manipulate people, to try to anticipate who would be insurgents, to ruin people's lives. And we're talking everything from, things about their participation in insurgent groups to their personal life, their sex life, their financial records. And so you had this systematic attempt to collect this information and use that information to manipulate people to get outcomes. Van Diemen finishes up. He comes back to America in the early 1900s. he goes to work to try to set up a similar apparatus domestically. He meets a variety of bureaucratic barriers to doing this. It wasn't like a smooth process where he just snapped his fingers and it happened, but World War I, or the onset of World War I, presented him with the opportunity to do this. And he established one of the first kind of systematic surveillance operations. It was very small. It was only him and a few people in America. And it slowly expanded over time. At one point in time, and it went through a variety of iterations, like any kind of bureaucracy. It had a whole host of different names, if you look at it, which eventually became the NSA. The NSA was formed in 1952, I believe, and that's the year Van Diemen died. So it kind of his vision came to full maturation and came to be fulfilled at the end of his life. You see these crazy things when you read about it. At one point, it's called the American Black Chamber. They had set up a business front in New York City, and they it was a small group of people. It wasn't like this huge apparatus. So these people sitting in this building in New York City, and they entered into these backroom agreements with all the major wire, Western Union, which of course was one of the major telecommunication companies with international communications over wires. And you had a small group of members of the American military reading all these things, having access to all this information. Then, of course, you come up through the revelations that led to the Church Committee, which again was massive spying, the abuse of these tools of surveillance to fight people that those with political power didn't like. And it wasn't just communists, it was civil rights leaders, others viewed as posing the broadest threat to members of the political elite. And then, of course, you have the Snowden revelations, which are, so you start going back and you're like, all right, the Snowden revelations come out and they're jarring for, 5 minutes for people to care about it, and they just move on to the next thing. And you quickly realize that this has been happening over and over again. The technology is different. The way that government implements it is different, but it's the same kind of stuff over and over again, which shouldn't be that shocking to people. One of the kind of core insights, which it's not new to us, it's been talked by political theorists and others for centuries, is kind of the paradox of government. The idea of look, we empower government to do stuff. In principle, they can do lots of good stuff, but of course they can also utilize that power to do lots of bad stuff. And so how do you simultaneously, or can you simultaneously empower government and constrain them? And really that's what's this all about. Can you simultaneously grant political agents, government, massive surveillance powers, which by definition are covert? They have to be in order to surveil people, because if they know they're being surveilled, they're not very effective, and simultaneously create constraints that are to prevent abuse. And that's really, in some sense, what this all comes down to. I would suggest the empirical record is very weak in coming up with effective constraints. And one kind of obvious metric for that is whistleblowers. As you mentioned earlier, Snowden is, that's typically how people find out about these things. But also, the members of government, when these things are revealed, will simultaneously point out that there's nothing there to see and invest a massive amount of resources discrediting the person and trying to punish the person, which should strike people as odd if there's nothing there to see. And so, it poses that tension of how you resolve these things and can you. But in the case of surveillance, it is kind of a perfect illustration of how a foreign intervention over a century ago kind of boomerangs back to domestic life and influences us today. The dynamics and nature of that has evolved, of course, but it's still there, and the foundations go all the way back to that intervention in the Philippines.
When we're talking about this, we talk in moralized language. So we need to prevent abuses. We need to stop them from doing things that they shouldn't do. But from a pure economic standpoint, are we just dealing with an instance of revealed preferences, in that like we in this room, or Trevor and I at the Cato Institute, like we think that this stuff, that a massive surveillance state is bad, privacy violations are bad, social control is bad, but maybe it's just the situation that Americans, despite the rhetoric of the American founding and are pointing to the Constitution, just simply like this stuff or want this stuff or aren't bothered at all by it. And we see that in responses like, well, I don't care if they surveil me because I'm not doing anything wrong, or if only we had even more cops busting heads in my neighborhood, that would be great. And so is this just an instance where weird civil libertarians have a set of preferences that are just not shared by anyone?
That's a wonderful point, and we discuss this in the book at the end, really, when we talk about kind of solutions. And one of the main things is exactly the point you raise, which is there's parts of a democratic system that operate outside the purview of what citizens want. Some people call it the deep state. whatever people want to call it. They're just given the nature of big bureaucracies, there's going to be stuff that happens that you can't monitor, that stuff's going to happen that you don't directly express your voice for. It's just the nature of the beast. But of course, that doesn't mean people don't have a voice. They can't express their views. And of course, there have been moments in American history and in other societies where people have had dramatically different preferences than what their government is doing. And they have expressed those either through voting or through some kind of revolt or protest and gotten change. What does this mean? At the end of the day, it means exactly the point you made, which is I do think many Americans, perhaps most Americans based on many opinion polls, are quite comfortable being surveilled. They say exactly the kind of things you're saying, that, you know, if you have nothing to hide, why would you worry about this? Or you know, I'm fine being patted down at the airport. It makes us safer. And there's the empirical aspect of that, like, does it make you safer? But then there's this broader point that we're trying to make about the long-term consequences of that. And so, you know, kind of where we conclude is that one of the things you need in order to reverse this, that you can't turn to politicians to reverse it. They have no incentive to reverse it. They like power. That's part of this. And they are going to continually work to take advantage of existing slack and the constraints and to expand that slack. And so where that leaves us is ultimately you need enough citizens, whatever enough means, to want to change things. And you know, we try to lay out the case here that they should care about it. We hope they do, because we think it's an important part of maintaining liberty and freedom. But ultimately, you're right. If people don't want it, if they are complicit in government doing it, government's going to do it.
Your next example is something I've worked on, police militarization. And Aaron's question about seen and unseen, the very beginning of your book, point out Ferguson, which was the first time that a lot of people saw something that had been going on for quite a while. And Radley Balco started his work on that Cato here. But I think it's also a really good example of the three elements of the boomerang effect. So you have the human capital channel, as we discussed. So you have military people coming back to policing. You have the organizational dynamics. Cops turn into militarized ranking and discipline, and in physical capital, like tanks altogether. But tell a little about that story.
So the militarization example, as you pointed out, I think is a really nice illustration, because we've got kind of all of the dynamics that we're talking about. And again, what we find is the start really in the Philippines, at least that's
always the Philippines. Yeah. We'll have to put the Stephen Kinzer episode in the show notes so they can go back and listen to that and then figure out all the stuff that started in the Philippines.
Right. So we start off by noting that historically there's been at least an attempt in theory, if not necessarily in practice, of trying to separate the functions of police from the military. So you look at something like the U.S. Soldiers' Creed about being ready to engage, deploy, and, you know, destroy enemies of the United States in close combat versus something like the LAPD model or motto to protect and serve. There's been a series of attempts, again, to codify that. So people who are familiar with it may be familiar with something like Posse Comitatus, which came on the books after the U.S. Civil War, where you had the U.S. Military, which was attempting to prevent Southern blacks from voting. That's violated almost immediately. But to really start with it, I think, again, the Philippines is the best place. So as Chris mentioned a few minutes ago, you have this resistance and the U.S. military, not constrained by things like Posse Comitatus when they're acting abroad, they develop a constabulary, so a military police force to control the civilian population. And as part of this, this allows for the development of and this honing of various styles of policing, some of which remarkably brutal, which we do detail in the chapter. And from this, you get a man named August Vollmer, who becomes known as the father of modern policing. So Vollmer is part of the Philippine Constabulary. He returns home. He joins the police department at Berkeley. He becomes Berkeley's police chief throughout his tenure. He will also spend, I believe it's a year or two, as Los Angeles police chief. And he also serves as a consultant to a variety of different police departments. And if you read what people have written about Vollmer, if you read, again, his biographers or contemporaries of his, they talk about it as he felt as though martial law, or people felt that martial law was in place when he was police chief, and he felt like that worked to his advantage. And he was of the opinion that police should be run like the military. And so that's what he set out to do. he was a fan of things like universal fingerprinting for every citizen in the United States, something that he was not able to successfully champion, but was a big proponent of implementing the types of tactics and technologies that had been developed as part of this occupation of the Philippines. So things that we might not think about today as being huge technological innovations, but things like having police officers on bicycles or them being able to call into the police station with a, you know, telephone or telegraph, or putting police officers in cars when cars became available. It's appropriate that several years later, in another case that we talk about related to police militarization. And I think it's important to point out, too, that we see this not happening all at once. We do see this occurring in layers. So it's not this clean linear trajectory. It's piecemeal. You get to the war in Vietnam, and you have yet more foreign intervention, more opportunities to hone methods of social control. And you have the Watts riots in Los Angeles in the mid-1960s. And then you have a guy named John Nelson. He was a Marine veteran, had served in Vietnam, and he'd been part of an elite force recon unit. Now, you hear reconnaissance unit, you think intelligence gathering. They're effectively an elite killing force. So we have stuff about engagement statistics, casualty rates for elite force recon units versus regular Marine units. And John Nelson looks at these riots that are occurring in Los Angeles, thinking about his time in Vietnam. He is now a member of the LAPD. He takes this idea to his superior, at the time an inspector. He'd later become the police chief of the LAPD, named Daryl Gates. And he proposes to him this idea. He says, I think I have a way for us to better control these crowds at race riots. And he proposed to model a unit within the LAPD based on this elite force recon unit. This would eventually turn into the first SWAT team. And I think in a very pointed example of how this militarization of policing has come in, or the foreign intervention aspect, the proposed title was Special Weapons and Attack Team, but it was thought that that was too militaristic and too harsh, so they changed it to Special Weapons and Tactics Teams. This very quickly becomes a permanent fixture of the LAPD. Every member of the original SWAT team for the LAPD had military training and experience. And the idea, as we now know, from work like people like Radley Balco and others, has spread very quickly, which yet again, we can tie in to these foreign interventions abroad. So those who are familiar with that topic might be aware of things like Program 1033, which has gone through various iterations. It's the program that allows for the military to transfer surplus military equipment to police departments. So you start to see all of those dynamics that we talk about coming in. So you've got this human capital that is being infused at all these different points. So mentioned Vollmer a few moments ago. It's not just Vollmer. You have people who are doing similar things in West Virginia, people who are doing similar things in Pennsylvania with the experiences that they have. Other people who are coming back from Vietnam and now in a contemporary context, returning from Iraq and Afghanistan and the War on Terror, bringing in those mindsets with them, developing these different organizational dynamics in a way that people who are former or current members of the military would also recognize what's going on in a policing context, because those are the dynamics that have been put in place. And then you bring in these programs which allow for the use of military-grade equipment. And it really, I think, ultimately comes as no surprise that this is where we are. But we've got this historical context of foreign intervention really being kind of the cradle of this very now hotly contested contemporary issue.
While this was happening, to go back to the cultural question that I asked earlier, what was the reaction of people in, say, Los Angeles when the first SWAT teams came in, or as the militarization went up? Like, was this move being cheered on by the general populace, or
One of the tricky things about engaging in this type of research is that some of those types of questions, and that's a really good question, is that you don't always have that kind of information. My guess would be is that it would probably have been a mixed bag. So you probably would have had some people who were largely championing this as a move and other people who would probably be detractors, very similar to what we see today with respect to police militarization. Anytime I'm giving or talking about that as a topic, you run into something very similar to what we were discussing earlier of, well, if you're not doing anything wrong, then you don't have anything to worry about. Or they'll typically bring up something about what police are confronting and then ask questions like, well, don't you want police to have what they need in order to be able to do their job? So the short answer to that question is I don't really know.
Well, there definitely seemed to be a pretty high level of demand for among some people for criminal justice, for cracking heads, let's put it in that way, in the late 60s, to turmoil of the 60s, race concerns, the drug war, all this stuff comes up. So it's not just a, hey, we're going to impose this new SWAT team thing on you because I was in Vietnam.
And I think the war on drugs piece, and we talk about this in the book, is the war on drugs and the war on terror being yet another mechanism through which we see kind of the expansion of police militarization. And a large part of that has to do with that dynamic of there are now domestic enemies which are present and part of this ongoing perpetual war on drugs or war on terror. And therefore, in order to be able to effectively, the story goes, do our job, we need to be able to have this type of equipment or use these particular tactics, which, even though they were once relegated to the military, are argued to be more appropriate or effective at doing the job.
But you wouldn't make this, just to be clear about this, you wouldn't make the strong claim that but for Vietnam, we wouldn't have SWAT teams, right? I mean, how I guess inevitable does this seem? And in trying to sort of demonstrate the thesis, do we see other countries maybe or other empire, like British Empire, do we see this happen too? Or for any of you of their other examples, like how would the world look? I mean, there was demand for high level of policing. So maybe it was just that all these people had been in a war and then they had an easy option for being in the cops. You know, you say Daryl Gates was in World War II, but so was like every single person about his age at the time, right? And probably, you know, not all of them were that way. So, you know, how strong is the thesis here?
So that's a great question. And we don't want to overstate the strength, I guess the more accurate way to put it is the predictive power of the thesis. You know, in the book, we are very careful both early on and throughout to say that the kind of the boomerang effect is first of all, just one factor that influences the growth of government. There are, you know, in every attempt to talk about the growth of government runs into this problem, which is it's extremely complex. But of course, to gain any kind of analytic tractability, you have to focus on certain aspects and kind of either hold others constant or push them off the table. And so, you know, how would have things evolved absent any particular war? That I don't know. That's an interesting counterfactual to think about. Do I think that it was inevitable that either militarization of police or one of these other things would have happened absent a war? I imagine most of them still would have happened in some way, shape, or form. Again, this is me speculating, but the dynamics would have been different. But I do want to make clear that you know we're not saying this is the only cause of growth, that there's kind of a deterministic type of thing that's happening, or that it has to happen. You know, again, one of the key kind of insights of the book is this isn't the foregone way that life has to be. Things can be different. That requires certain things. And pointing out how things occurred, I think, is important for, number one, understanding how they occurred, but also for assuming people want to either constrain them or make changes to reverse them, for understanding how to go about that. And so, you know, that's how I think about it. It gets even more complex, by the way, because these things are all intertwined. So in the book, we talk about surveillance and militarization of police. Of course, these things are linked, right? Because, well, you know, in this, there's lots of present day examples of this that happened, that came to light just as we were publishing the book and after. You know, one of the main ones, of course, is the surveillance technologies that were developed in Iraq that came back to America that are employed by police forces. Stingray is one of them. You know, this idea of this real-time regional gateway, which was this kind of algorithm developed by the military in Iraq and Afghanistan. And it's great. It's great for tracking and helping members of the military to track and kill what they consider to be the enemy. The question then you have to wonder what happens when that comes home. So then they say, okay, now we have this technology. Well, let's deploy it at the southern border because we have immigration concerns, we have drug concerns, we have terrorist concerns. But of course, it doesn't just stay at the border. It's not just used to against bad people. It collects a lot of information on a lot of people that may be bad, but may not be. And then you have to think about the implications of that. And so you get this blurring between the surveillance kind of capabilities of government, militarization of police, and it gets really complex really quick. But you can see how this kind of stuff manifests itself domestically and how you just get example after example, some in the immediate term, some in the longer term.
You'd asked about potential other examples and does this occur other places? And we were careful in the book to point out, or the framework that we've developed is generalizable. And so we do not think that this is in any way, shape, or form exclusive to the United States. Other governments that would engage in foreign intervention, we'd expect to see this elsewhere. One of the things that I found both intriguing and at times frustrating about writing this book was the amount of digging and the amount of historical knowledge and the amount of detail that you have to have about a variety of different things in order to really have an understanding of just the complexity of any one of these issues. And so in the book, we chose to focus on the United States. There are some other examples in the US, which I think are of interest. So looking at things like human rights abuses or human experimentation is something that we've looked at. You can also look at things like far-right extremism. So looking at the intersection of the military and organizations like the KKK. Those things are also contemporary U.S. examples. I would be very interested with people who have more knowledge about specific countries than I do to see what kinds of examples that they might be able to use this framework to discuss and illuminate.
The ones that I was thinking, Rome and the British Empire, of course, are ones that are similar scale as the American Empire. And I mean, it would be interesting. I don't have enough knowledge, but I imagine maybe, you know, Roman people going to serve as governors of Gaul might have come back and been like, well, you got to really keep those Gauls down and like learn some techniques of sort of oppression, or British governors in India, you know, might have learned some things and brought them back home. But it does take some more research. And I think in general, it seems like that we talk about what to do. We've identified a problem, which I think you guys are correct about this. But it's not totally deterministic, but it has these elements to it. And we have one coming. At one chapter, you discuss drones, which we're having domestic.
Did those begin in the Philippines too?
No, but
they
close.
Did in World War I, though. I was shocked about that one, right. Yeah. Tell about the drone's origin, yeah.
So drones, as we think about them, as we point out, not quite Philippines early, but we're getting pretty close. So in 1914, you see the first attempts at making some kind of an aerial drone. They're used at first for target practice. Over the years, capabilities get better. So really, you start to see the development of things like smaller cameras, microprocessing systems, things like that. During the Cold War, they're used for surveillance. We talk about reasons why. Things like if you were to shoot down a surveillance drone over the Soviet Union, that's a bit more politically easy to deal with. So we see this continuous development where we really see drones getting picked up and used extensively is primarily, again, in the War on Terror. And while there is this historical build up to that, so it's not as though all of a sudden we just get this technology right around the year 2001, 2003. But we do see that once that technology is developed, we start to see almost immediately, and this is one of the things that I think is particularly interesting about the case of drones, is that once that technology starts to be used, what I would argue, more extensively by the military. So for extensive surveillance and then also again for active targeting. Once that technology starts to be used in that way in the War on Terror, you see pretty much immediately, like within the same year, that those same drone technologies are being used along the U.S. border. There are certain people who play a pivotal role, like Arthur Sobrowski is somebody that we discuss in the book as being particularly important for really pushing in a very similar way that we saw in the chapter on surveillance, becomes an integral part of pushing for the use of these unmanned technologies, of these more advanced computer systems as a way to modernize the military. Again, someone who is coming from the perspective of this is technology that has been successfully used abroad. This can also be successfully used in domestically in a meaningful way. Bringing drones again forward to 2019, we see now Police departments, again, Chris mentioned a few moments ago that one of the things that makes it so complex is it all gets woven together. So you have surveillance, you have police militarization, and you have drones all simultaneously. Drones being utilized by police departments for things like surveillance, drones being loaned out to police departments from like customs enforcement and border patrol, and also discussions of things like using armed drones by police departments being met with varying degrees of opposition. So again, you have some people who are big fans of this and other people who are understandably, I think, concerned about the security threat or the threat to liberties that that poses.
But is that the difficulty here about, is it kind of underscores the what do we do about this? Because it's very hard to make a case against drones in general. I mean, from a military standpoint, if we're not putting people in harm's way and we can accomplish a task, that's better than the alternative, it seems, from any military. When you design military gear, you design them to protect your people and hurt them. Like a tank is about that. And if you don't even have to put a person in there, so that's military drones seem like not a bad idea from a military perspective. And then if we apply that domestically, we say, well, you shouldn't use drones, even though they're very good at doing that thing that we're trying to do, which is protect the lives of officers and soldiers and getting the bad guys. So how do we change the culture? How do we change ideas that there is something wrong with this, when you have to also admit that it's effective at doing many of the things that people think should be done?
So I think to point out, and this goes back, first point is that we don't make the argument that any of this technology is inherently bad. So for drones, for instance, they have very useful applications in things like combating fires or even like agricultural implications. Search and rescue drones can be very good. So we don't make any kind of claim that any one technology is inherently bad. In terms of how do you change the culture surrounding it, I think it really goes back to this idea of the paradox of government that Chris mentioned earlier, of that we can see the potentially beneficial uses for these technologies. With drones, there's a question, by the way, about whether or not they're actually safer for military personnel. There's some data, I think convincing data, that indicates they may actually put more soldiers in harm's way, and they have some psychological effects that are important to discuss. But that aside, figuring out, well, if we want, you know, police officers, for instance, to be able to use drones in the event of some kind of a crisis, however we want to define what an appropriate crisis would be, how do we design rules to allow police departments to utilize technologies, or the military or whoever, to utilize these technologies in a way that we achieve results that we find acceptable, however we want to define that? And how do we constrain them to prevent the abuse of these? So one thing that people are typically concerned about, something like, should drones be used to do things like monitor cars and issue people speeding tickets? People seem to be particularly irritated about that, perhaps a lot less than they are about them using drones for surveillance.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoy Free Thoughts, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or in your favorite podcast app. Free Thoughts is produced by Tess Terrible and Landry Ayers. To learn more, visit us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.